Don't tell me you've never changed your mind on something important.
I actually did vote for the family trip to Maui before I voted against it.
Read my lips. No more TV in the house.
Now, whether we have good reason or not, we change our minds all the time. It's human nature. But every few years, this otherwise very natural thing, the change of mind, change of heart, change of opinion, it gives birth to a political insult of the highest order. A silly phrase that settles in for a long stay until someone is finally elected. It is that term that brings us here tonight. This is In the Loop. I'm Jeff Horwich, and I'm going to let tonight's term introduce itself.
He will, in one sense, flip-flop.
Flip-flopping on some keys.
I don't like to use the word flip-flop, but the fact is
John Kerry-like flip-flop.
It sounds like a flip-flop.
It's not the only thing. He's accused of flip-flopping.
Based on whether she'd flip-flop.
Completely reverse one's political position.
Flip-flop.
Flip-flop is right.
As we're taping this show, Will Shorts, of course, for those who missed the joke, as we're taping this show, late 2007, flip-flop season is off to a strong start. Here's a quick recap for you. Hillary Clinton's flipping on the war and giving driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. McCain and Giuliani are flopping into the arms of the religious right. Obama's gotten the label for backtracking on foreign policy statements, like whether he'd unilaterally invade Pakistan. Romney's flip-flopping on... Well, we don't have that kind of time here tonight. From a term that almost no one used, even... really, 10, 15 years ago, this hyphenated harpoon has become a staple of our political discourse. For pundits and campaign operatives, the rise of flip-flop must be kind of nirvana. It's not so clear the rest of us, the voters, the little folks, are completely sold on the concept.
It has an attitude in that word. You wouldn't say, oh, thank you very much for your very thoughtful reconsideration of this challenging situation.
Our political discourse these days makes any change in a political position look like flip-flopping, no matter what the motive.
Politicians don't have an opportunity to justify why their opinions have changed, regardless of if it is legitimate.
It's a political weapon.
I don't think it's a word that we should even use. We should forget about it.
Unfortunately, I think we're stuck with it. So we might as well get to know it a little bit better. Where did it come from? Who controls what, and who gets stuck with that label? What's that fine difference between a flip-flop and an actual legitimate change of heart? And why do we make this distinction between politicians and the choices we make in our own lives? Don't we flip-flop too every now and then? Flip-flop fever is what we're calling this episode, and if you aren't infected by now, you'll have it by the end of the hour. Our band over here, The Smarts, is with us, of course, and we've got all kinds of actors and contributors in the house tonight. As always, this includes our live audience here at Minnesota Public Radio. So, whether you're with us in person or by radio or podcast, thank you for flipping us on. This is In the Loop. Now, the inspiration for our show tonight really is this single phrase. So when it comes to parsing the English language, Minnesota Public Radio has a podcast. It's called Grammar Grader, and they're particularly good at this kind of thing. Luke Taylor is one of the folks behind it. Hey, Luke.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, of course. Grammar Grader, for people who don't know, it's all about taking a fun look at grammar and usage.
That's right. It's surprising how much fun you can have just playing with words.
Now, you brought some of your gang along here. What did you guys uncover for us about flip-flop?
Well, it's interesting, Jeff. Flip-flop is actually in a family of words that are created by a process called reduplication. And what that means is the repetition of a same or similar sound. Other words in this family include things like knick-knack, flim-flam, hodgepodge, shilly-shally, and hoity-toity. And like flip-flop, these words are often hyphenated. And we found that flip-flop has a number of meanings, and one of those meanings comes from the world of electronics.
In digital circuits, a flip-flop is a kind of bistable multivibrator, an electronic circuit that's capable of serving as one bit of memory.
Fascinating.
Now, in addition to that thing, flip-flop is also a kind of bicycle hub. It's a handspring in gymnastics. And, of course, we're all familiar with its use in the world of fashion. Flip-flops, a.k.a. thongs.
Ooh, I just love to grab my thongs and head out to the beach.
Oh, my.
And now, of course, the thing you've all been waiting for, the political meaning of flip-flop. And that's when a political person has a sudden real or apparent change of policy or opinion. Now, to understand this better, let's follow a fictitious politician, Senator John Q. Sample, as he takes his whistle-stop tour.
Hello, Senator Sample. It's a pleasure to meet you. I'm with the Dairy Farmers Association.
Let me assure you that if elected, I promise to declare the milkshake one of the most beneficial drinks to humankind.
I'm darn glad to hear that. You've got my vote.
Why, thank you.
Senator Sample, I'm with the Heart Association, and I'd like to know your position on milkshakes.
Well, let me say that I'm opposed to milkshakes due to their fatty content.
Now, that is an example of a flip-flop. Now, if you listen carefully, you'll hear that in the political sense, the word flip-flop can be used as a noun and as a verb.
Senator Sample, how do you respond to the allegations on this whole flip-flopping issue of the milkshakes?
I have not, I do not, and I will never flip-flop.
But there are reports that...
I am not a flip-flopper.
Now, the word flip-flop earned a great deal of attention in the U.S. presidential election of 2004. But we found that the term goes at least as far back as the 1988 campaign. In the run-up to that year's election, Michael Dukakis took out a television ad showing acrobats doing flips, and he accused rival Richard Gephardt of flip-flops on abortion and minimum wage issues. Then, in a March 23, 1988 op-ed in the Washington Post, Dukakis was himself accused of flip-flopping on proposed trade legislation. And the idea of flip-flop is not limited to American politics. It's much more widespread. In Sweden, a flip-flop is referred to as kapvandra, and this translates as someone who turns their coat to the changing winds. In Romania, a flip-flop is fluturaș, which means butterfly. It's sort of the political equivalent of a social butterfly. And of course, many other English-speaking countries use flip-flop as well.
There were no new policies, fireworks, or flip-flops.
Flip-flop is clearly a popular and valued political term throughout the world.
Why would that be? It's kind of a weird word.
Yeah, why is flip-flop so popular? Why don't we call it a U-turn or something?
Now, those are great questions. So let's turn to our friend Gordon Jarvie, the author of the Bloomsbury Grammar Guide. Remember, as we said earlier, flip-flop is a word that's formed by reduplication.
Many of these reduplicative words involve an element of rhyme, which is what makes them memorable and ensures the contemporary colloquial popularity of this aspect of word formation. Nowadays, we all seem to love a rhyme.
Hey, he's right. Flip-flop is a fun word. Flip-flop, flip-flop, flip-flop.
Oh, yes. And it works so well in those sound bites and attack ads.
Let's hear it for our folks from the Grammar Grader podcast joining us here on In the Loop. All the folks involved with Grammar Grader, Luke Taylor, of course, with the Grammatis Personae players, Bridget Murphy, Corey Bussey, and John Ryan, with Michael Bailey and some help from Brett Baldwin and Jen Hauk. You can get that podcast by finding Grammar Grader in the list of programs at minnesotapublicradio.org. Give it a listen. I'm Jeff Horwich. You're listening to In the Loop. So let's talk flip-flop science, flip-flop strategy. Along with all of our staff, our producer, Julie Seipel, has been getting a case of flip-flop fever over the past couple of weeks.
Yeah, I'm starting to think this flip-flop business is getting out of hand.
What do you mean?
I mean, at the Minnesota State Fair, political activists give out flip-flops on a stick. Interns are showing up at campaign speeches wearing Flipper the Dolphin costumes. And we've got grown men running around in foam rubber waffle costumes chasing people on the campaign trail.
Right, Waffle Man. Actually, I think we're going to talk about him a little bit later in the show.
Yep.
So, Julie, how has it come to this?
Well, I talked to a man named Terry Cooper because it turns out some of these flip-flop charges begin in his townhouse.
Okay, shall we start at the basement?
So Terry Cooper is a flip-flopper's biggest nightmare. He lives in a three-story house just outside D.C., and the whole place is his office, every floor. It's packed with political data.
The wall I'm facing is nothing but congressional records.
Terry has worked for more than 20 years for Republican campaigns, big ones, like for Newt Gingrich. He's like a flip-flop detective.
Even in my bedroom, there are the uniform crime reports from various states. data from the Internal Revenue Service.
Terry does what's called opposition research. He combs through everything. Everything an opposing candidate ever said, wrote, paid for, voted on.
I've got the most recent congressional roll call book, and I'm looking at page H84, which is...
Terry spends hundreds of hours cross-referencing this information, looking for inconsistencies in a candidate's voting record.
I will make a note of that. And then when the next time that vote comes up, I'll see if he voted for or against.
One flip-flop's not enough. Terry's looking for a series of them. And here's the thing. Once you have a bunch, it doesn't really even matter what the candidate's changing his mind about.
You just tell him, well, he flip-flopped on this, he flip-flopped on that, he flip-flopped on the other. And he's put in a pretty difficult position of either trying to explain what he did or just letting the charge stick unanswered.
Terry's heard a million excuses or explanations from flip-floppers over the years.
I didn't understand what I was being asked to vote on. A good buddy colleague said it was important to him and asked for my help. The debate persuaded me to change. That's a really good one.
When Terry finds something juicy, he passes it on to his client, often a campaign manager. Then it's the job of the campaign workers to make these charges stick, despite the excuses. To figure out how, I called up the other guys.
I'm Damian Lavera. I'm a spokesperson for the Democratic National Committee.
Damian Lavera works for the DNC in Washington. His job is to spin the kind of raw information Terry comes up with into political gold. How does he do that?
We integrate it into our entire messaging operation.
In other words, they get the message out.
We will do it in interviews. We'll do it as press releases. If we find stuff, we share it with some friendly blogs. And then we just keep a list of reporters who are covering these candidates and just make sure they can compare what a candidate says today to what they did in the past.
So I couldn't get the DNC to spill their darkest secrets.
I would prefer not to answer that on the record.
But basically, it's almost like there's this big machine cranking out flip-flop charges. You think, after a while, once the debate devolves into grown men walking around in waffle suits, we'd tune out. So why does the charge still stick?
There is a general mistrust of politicians out there.
That's Catherine Pearson. She's a political science professor, so she watches this stuff.
And so the notion of flip-flopping, or constantly changing one's mind for depending on which way the political winds blow, that really makes voters nervous.
So basically, flip-flopping hits a nerve because we're all so afraid our politicians are playing us for fools. We're hypersensitive about it.
Voters want to know that politicians are acting in the best interests of the country rather than in the best interests of their particular political pursuits.
Actually, everyone in this story, everyone we've heard from, says it's pretty easy to catch a candidate in a flip-flop and cast doubt on their motivations. So it almost feels sleazy, just sitting around waiting for candidates to stumble. But Terry, you remember Terry.
In the living room are the economic reports of the president, statistical
for
abstracts
him,
of
the... searching out the stumbles, the flip-flops, it's really important.
Well, I'm looking for a better class of legislator. And I hope there are Democrats out there who are doing the same. Because we've got some wonderful people in office, but we've got some real jokers, too. And to the extent you can show voters that this guy is a bum, I think you're doing a public service.
Okay, but Julie, what about the other politicians who get caught up in this machine, who are unfairly nailed with a flip-flop?
Yeah, well, after talking to Catherine Pearson, I started to wonder if maybe that's not partly our fault, the voters.
Okay, our fault. How's that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe we're so afraid that our politicians are trying to dupe us that we just won't let them change their minds.
It's good food for thought as we move ahead into the program. Thank you, Julie. Julie Seipel, our producer here on In the Loop. Let's get a different angle now on political flip-flopping from Dave Colling. Dave, thank you very much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you, Jeff.
Now, Dave's been managing or working on Democratic political campaigns for years, including doing opposition research for Clinton Gore back in 1996. Most recently, he helped Minnesota send Keith Ellison to the House of Representatives. Ellison represents part of Minneapolis and is the first Muslim to ever serve in Congress. You were the campaign manager on that campaign, correct?
That's correct.
Dave's currently the COO of Campaign Services Corporation, which is a political consulting firm here in the Twin Cities. So I'm going to sum up some history here fairly quickly, but make sure you're with me. You took over the Ellison campaign right when he was being accused of, I don't know, let's say, kind of changing his stripes because he's running for higher office. I mean, in a nutshell, Ellison wrote an article back in law school.
Correct.
Sounded like he was supporting Louis Farrakhan, the leader of the Nation of Islam. Mm-hmm. So here he is trying to run for Congress, and he's trying to say what? That's just not how I feel anymore?
Exactly. He came out and said, yes, I wrote that, and that's how I felt at the time. And he, you know, he said, should have looked at the policies a little bit better of Louis Farrakhan. But at the time, he didn't. And over the years, changed his position.
So your job in this situation, campaign manager, is to let people know that the change he's made is real. For the sake of this discussion, I'm sure it's still debated some places, but let's just say it is. How do you avoid getting your guy tagged as a flip-flopper?
In that case, we were quite certain that was going to come up before it did. And we knew it was out there. And that's one of the first things to do is opposition research, as Terry from the Republican Party was saying, not just on your opponents, but on yourself, on your own candidates. And one of the ways it got out was, of course, the campaign sent a letter to the JCRC, the Jewish Community Relations Council, explaining it before we were asked to.
So, as always, you know, the best defense is a good offense.
Exactly.
What do you do if you don't see it coming? I mean, a lot of times this turns into just damage control.
You know, Bill Clinton was actually one of the best folks at doing this. Was when he was attacked with something, would just be to come back and open up about it. Full disclosure, as we would say. Just be open and honest about it. But many times they're really not flip-flops. Many times they're taken out of context.
But isn't a flip-flop kind of what the media says it is?
That's true.
It's a flip-flop if people call it a flip-flop.
That's true, exactly right. But I think it's in the end, it's the campaign's job to educate the voters, not necessarily media's job.
How easy is it to talk voters past the notion that there's just a flip-flop of some sort going on and get them to think about the details?
Well, it depends on the flip-flop. Sometimes you may not want to necessarily get past it. An example of that, in the Ellison campaign, Congressman Ellison was attacked for, it was said he sent his kids to private school. Wasn't true. And it was a very easy way for us to go right into Keith Ellison's education policies. So we didn't necessarily run away from that attack.
So there can sometimes be a silver lining, mm-hmm. I guess, if what you're charged with flip-flopping on is something you want to talk about anyway.
Exactly. I mean, the whole idea of charging somebody with flip-flopping or whatever it is to allow yourself to control the message of the campaign, get your opponent off message. They have to talk about it. If they're explaining, they're not gaining, is the term we would use.
Do you sometimes like the fact that flip-flop is getting thrown around? You're a political junkie, campaigner.
Political hack.
You're a political hack. I said at the beginning of the show that maybe this is kind of like, you know, nirvana, this notion of flip-flop all over the place for people who work in politics. Do you yourself feel that way? Can you feel that energy around it?
You know, it does bring a lot of energy to the campaign. A lot of times it energizes our base. When your candidate is attacked, it brings out a lot of folks to come make phone calls and go do door knocking, which is really what wins the campaign in the end. Helps in the fundraising sometimes, too. Every time there was a hit piece on the Ellison campaign, our fundraising would go up about 20% for the next 2 days, especially when they would attack him, you know, on religious grounds. We would get donations from all over the country when things like that would happen. So it wasn't always a bad thing.
Dave, thank you very much for joining us here. Dave Colling, longtime political advisor and recent campaign manager for Congressman Keith Ellison. You know, I think most of us still remember right where we were and what we were doing when flip-flop first truly arrived on the political scene.
I actually did vote for the $87 billion before I voted against it.
Yeah, I remember that. You know, in 2004, John Kerry became kind of Mr. Flip-flop. The flip-flop label may have actually decided, at least in part, a contest for president of the United States. But in fact, the flip-flop has a strong presidential pedigree. Zip back 4 years before Kerry.
I don't think our troops should be used for so-called nation building.
That's our actor friend Gary Grooms here helping us out with some voices. But of course, he's quoting George W. Bush back when he was still governor of Texas. As president, well, let's just say things changed. Now, Bush took over the White House from Bill Clinton, whose critics can cite a long list of changes in position.
I did not flip-flop with that woman.
And I think we're talking about changes in political position here, Gary.
Oh. Yeah.
For Clinton, you know, defense issues were a hot spot. In 1999, under strong political pressure, Clinton switched sides and decided to support a missile defense system. He campaigned on the promise to let gays serve openly in the military, but then reversed course and approved Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
It's an honorable compromise. We must and we will protect unit cohesion and the troops' morale.
That's an actual quote from him at the time. Now, before Clinton, Bush Sr. got slapped with kind of a flip-flop classic.
Read my lips. No new taxes.
Right. 2 years later, Bush Sr. caved to pressure from both parties and agreed to hike taxes just a little bit. Now, Ronald Reagan was also famous for a big tax-related flip-flop, but he handled it differently. As governor of California, he refused for years to introduce state tax withholding.
And my feet are in concrete on that one.
That's what he said. But in 1970, as the state budget got tighter, he gave way.
Well, that sound you hear is the concrete cracking around my feet.
Also the actual quote. Reagan met the challenge head on, it is, and admitted he was going back on a promise, but he made a joke out of it. Now, we can go back way before 1970 for major flip-flops. Flip-flops that shaped the course of world history. How about ancient Rome in the year 313? Emperor Constantine made waves. Thank you, trumpet. Emperor Constantine made waves with a document called the Edict of Milan.
For the sake of the peace of our times, each one may have the free opportunity to worship as he pleases.
The idea was to help out the Christians. The young religion was often persecuted. But not long after Constantine himself converts to Christianity, suddenly religious freedom in the empire is far from guaranteed, especially if you're Jewish. And Christianity begins its rise to become the world's dominant faith. There have been lots of big flip-flops on religious beliefs. Take the former king of England, Henry VIII. Now, Henry was a deeply religious Roman Catholic who, we're told, loved a good two-hour sermon.
I am very sorry to hear how irreverently that most precious jewel, the Word of God, is disputed contrary to the true meaning and doctrine of the same.
The Pope even gave Henry a special title, Defender of the Faith. That all changed when the church refused to let him divorce the queen.
Gadzooks! I'm out of here!
He broke off from Rome, founded the Anglican Church, and went on to have six wives, as a matter of fact. Now, jump a couple centuries ahead to China. Mao Zedong had just taken over. In keeping with the whole People's Revolution thing, Mao starts the so-called 100 Flowers campaign. This lets pretty much anyone submit their thoughts on how the government should run. But when people start complaining, the policy gets a little tweak. Instead of soliciting free and open ideas, the government starts to hunt down and prosecute everyone who spoke up. Before we move on, thanks to our versatile political impersonator, Gary Grooms, for helping us out this evening. We'll see him again a little later in the show. I thought his Emperor Constantine was dead on. Just a few of the flip-flops that shaped our modern world. And when you think about it, our great country, the nation that has elevated the flip-flop to the highest political insult, we would not be what we are without some pretty major flips and flops of our own. From our modern political campaigns, you'd think sticking to your guns, never changing your position, is the most admirable thing you can do. Where would we be if this kind of thinking truly ruled the day?
Where would we be if we could never change our minds? Standing firm to please the crowd, just to cover our behinds. A colony swore allegiance to the crown, but a changing circumstance forced a major turnaround. So it came to be woven deep within the big flip-flop that helped this place begin. Go ahead and change your stance like a true American. Yeah. Now, Thomas Jefferson thought the government should stay very weak and very small, keep itself out of the way. And he thought that we should stay in the black, that we shouldn't take on debt that we couldn't soon repay. But then France Vance offered up a deal too good to miss. A TJ could buy the Louisiana freaking Purchase. Come on. You know you put your stance aside for huge tracts of land like this. Here we go. Lincoln said that he would not mess with the South throughout all of his campaigns. That's what came out of his mouth. And he said that the slaves could not be free, that the races weren't the same, there'd be no equality. Well, that all changed when Dixie tried to split. You know that Honest Davy was having none of it. And he changed his mind on some pretty important stuff. Now Franklin Roosevelt said he would never go to war. Woodrow Wilson said the same thing 20 years before. Well, where would we be if we could never change our minds? Standing firm to please the crowd, just to cover our behinds. If those two stuck to what they had decreed, their vice be like Dick for the Jetzt, singing auf Deutsch dieses Lied. Yeah!
Thank you very much. I'd been threatening to write a ska song for the show for months now. And there you have it. Of course, I get by with a little help from the smarts and helping my sax round out the horn section, our show's editor, Jim Gates, on trumpet, and our technical director, Josh Kubasta, on trombone. Talented crew we have here. I'm Jeff Horwich. You're listening to In the Loop. We are online at minnesotapublicradio.org/in the loop. Okay, so we're going to bring the lights up here in the UBS Forum at Minnesota Public Radio, toss things out to our wonderful audience. So far on the show, we've looked inside the political flip-flop machine. We've talked about what it's like for a campaign to cope on the other side. I hope we've gotten kind of a sense that flip-flopping, you know, might not be all good or all bad. Here's what we heard from one of you, a listener of the show, when we brought up flip-flopping after a recent show taping.
We don't want our leaders to be followers and essentially a flip-flopper who goes with the tide, and I don't necessarily want to put my faith in somebody who doesn't know how to lead.
Now, the media, the campaigns, seem to think that flip-flopping itself is something that voters react strongly to. They think it works. Does it work on you? Yeah, right here.
My name is Josh. I'm from Minneapolis. And I think that political flip-flopping is kind of like the modern political witch hunt. Seems to me that it's better to change your mind than to be wrong and strong.
How do you judge if somebody is genuine or if they're just faking it to get your vote?
Usually I just kind of go with a gut instinct about what I know about the politician already.
Thanks very much. Let's keep going. Let's get somebody else. Flip-flop culture. Does it work on you? Are you willing to believe that politicians might change? Yeah, right over here. Give us your name and where you're from.
I'm Richard from St. Paul. If they can provide a rationale, a thoughtful rationale about why they changed their mind, you know, as opposed to pandering, I can go along with it.
It's hard to cut through the fact that so many other people are saying flip-flop.
Yeah.
Get to those details like we were talking about with Dave Colling earlier. Mm. Thank you very much. Now, the guy who's probably getting the biggest flip-flop attack right now is Mitt Romney. Basically, he used to have liberal positions on all kinds of things, and now he's running for president as a Republican, and he doesn't so much on some of those. At a debate just this week, another candidate played a clip of him declaring from a number of years ago that he was pro-choice. Here's how Romney responded.
I don't know how many times I could tell it. I was wrong. If people in this country are looking for someone who's never made a mistake on a policy issue and is not willing to admit they're ever wrong, why, then they're going to have to find somebody else.
All right, how does this approach strike you? Putting aside, you know, the specific issue in the candidate here, but if someone comes out and just says, I was wrong about it before, can you buy that? Yeah, right here.
Hey, I'm Tara from Minneapolis. I think it actually takes the power away from the attackers when they admit that they're wrong, because what they're trying to do by accusing them of flip-flopping is to get them to sort of be off guard. But then once they say, well, yes, I was wrong, then there's really nothing more to say.
But you have to admit that you were wrong about something. It doesn't happen very often in politics.
No, and I wish they would. I wish they would.
It doesn't seem weak to you.
No, I actually appreciate it. Even in politicians that I don't like or agree with, I appreciate them more and can respect them more when they say they're wrong, because I know I'm wrong and I change my positions on a lot of things all the time. So why wouldn't they?
Thank you for the perfect segue to where we are going next. We're going to go personal here for a little bit. Lots of you in the room here and many more people listening are in something we call our Public Insight Network. We kind of see this as our pool of collaborators for the show. Anybody can join up and help us build these episodes. You can go to minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. Look for the Join the Loop Network link over on the right-hand side. As we almost always do, we went to our network for stories in your own lives that feel like they might be flip-flops. Al Nowatzki got back to us, and he's made some fairly big changes in position in recent years. Al, thank you very much for coming on In the Loop.
Of course, glad to be here.
Now, quick fact about you before we hear what you've got. I'm told you come from a pretty small town, huh?
Yep, I grew up in Edinburgh, North Dakota, population 280.
Yep, that is small. And nowadays, they treat you a little bit differently when you go home for the holidays?
You could say that. You see, I'm an atheist, vegan, gay-friendly, stay-at-home dad. And I vote. Now, there's a bumper sticker for you. But I wasn't always this way. I used to be a devout Catholic. I went to church every Sunday. I had a cross hanging in my bedroom, and I said my prayers every night. And then I went off to college in Grand Forks, North Dakota. A strange thing happened at college. My universe started to expand. I took a class on world religion. I read Kurt Vonnegut. I listened to a lot of Radiohead. And here's the craziest part. I got to know people who were nothing like me at all. But I was still a Catholic. And then I interviewed the campus priest for a paper I was writing on Christianity and comic books. Somehow we got on the subject of homosexuality. He told me it was a sin because Jesus said so. I could still hear him. Unrepentant homosexuals are damned. Now, that didn't sound right to me. You see, I had a job at the local comedy club. The two managers who ran the place were really cool. They were the bosses, but they would hang out, play pool, and get a drink after work just like everyone else. And they were both openly gay. I just couldn't force myself to believe they were going to hell. The mantra, hate the sin, not the sinner, started to ring hollow. If you hate what someone is, then it logically follows that you hate that person. But my parents taught me to never hate anyone. After my interview with the priest, I went home, opened my Bible, and started to read it, really read it, for the first time in my life. The parts I didn't agree with far outweighed the parts I did. That realization started a ripple effect. I stopped going to church. I stopped praying. And instead of saying, God bless you, I started to say, Gesundheit. I remember the day I told my mom I wasn't Catholic anymore. She didn't yell or tell me I was wrong. She didn't have to. The short exhales coming out of her nose let me know that she was plenty disappointed. You see, when I was younger, my mom and I used to have these great, lively discussions about religion, the kind that opened our eyes and strengthened our bond. But we don't do that anymore. I wish we could still talk about it, but I doubt she wants to hear my opinion on the subject. People really hate it when someone they agree with suddenly changes their mind, whether it's a politician or a son. It's like a judgment of their whole worldview. I think that's how my parents felt. And when someone changes their mind like that, others want to know why. For me, I was just following the core set of values that my parents gave me. Love everybody. Don't hurt anybody. Eventually, I decided to extend this toward non-human animals as well. I decided to go vegan. Now, you need to understand, I loved meat. My mom used to make me BLTs without an L or a T. But when I realized the meat in my sandwich once had feelings, I couldn't eat it without being a hypocrite. It made sense to go vegan. And there were consequences to that change, too. A friend of mine said he would double his milk drinking and meat eating just to counteract my decision. We don't talk much anymore. A lot of my friends and family think that I've changed dramatically, but I feel like I'm still the same person. I still believe in family. I still love tacos, well, vegan tacos. I still believe all human and non-human animals should be treated with respect and compassion. The changes I made have only helped me live my life in a way that's more ethically consistent. Did I flip-flop? Am I a flip-flopper? I don't know. I don't really consider my changes flip-flops, but if you want to call me a flip-flopper, go right ahead. I don't need your vote. Just don't call me a hypocrite. It may look like I've done a complete 180, but I've been guided by the same values all my life. Show me a politician who can say that, and they've got my vote. Unless, of course, their values don't agree with mine.
That's Al Nowatzki. Thank you, Al. Now, Al helps take us to the other side. You know, we all change, sometimes in big ways, whether you agree or not with how he changed. I mean, that if that's a flip-flop, that's the best kind of flip-flop. It's amazing how differently we treat politicians when it comes to this stuff. I wonder, does this term apply out of politics? Does it work? Flip-flops in your own life? Or is it just a political thing? Yes, let's go right back here.
Hi, I'm Jefferson. I'm from Minnetonka. My approach to recycling is kind of a little version of a flip-flop, I'm a little ashamed to say. When I'm at home and it's convenient to recycle, because I have the recycling bin right there, I'll recycle. And I'll often get after people who don't do it in my home. Like, we have that for a reason. Please recycle. But when it's not convenient for me, like when I'm driving on a road trip and there's massive bottles that are piling up in my car and I'm a bit of a neat freak and there's no recycling bin anywhere nearby, I will opt to, you know, endanger the planet with bottles that will last for thousands of years because I would much prefer to have a cleaner car.
So your stance is solid up to a point.
Yes, it's just quite sad to
doesn't
say.
It doesn't take much
that,
for you to flip, maybe a road trip or having to spend some time in the car with a plastic bottle.
I know, it's quite sad.
Thanks, Jefferson. Now, we have a couple of folks here in our audience who we did talk to ahead of time about their flip-flops. Where is Anthony? There we go. Anthony, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Now, what was the flip-flop that you shared with us?
I actually flip-flopped on wanting to stay a member on the social networking site MySpace.
Okay.
I know it's kind of funny, but, you know, I was kind of invariably wasting all too much time. I was spending probably the equivalent of, like, 45 minutes to an hour a day on there. And there's actually, like, 3 or 4 steps. It takes, like, 20 minutes to cancel your account.
Dang.
It's not a short process. And then at the end, you actually have to write a little blurb to the administrator of the site as to why you are unsatisfied with your experience there.
Very complicated process.
So I figured since nobody's probably ever going to read this, I just kind of at that point decided, okay, forget it, I'm done with it. I'm just going
to
stick around. And
and
I've been on
here
ever
today,
since.
Yeah. Wasting time as usual.
It just took me a little longer to get to that point to where I thought, okay, you know, maybe this is worth sticking around.
Yeah, sure, awesome. But, you know, I don't care about the good stuff, Anthony Merwin.
Yes.
Because, you know, ordinary people don't get treated like politicians when they flip-flop. Except for tonight. So we've prepared for you, Anthony. We've asked Gary Grooms and Susan Fuller, some actor friends of ours who actually do some political ad voiceover work, to come and help us get a sense of what it might be like. And of course, we're going to need some music from Jimmy, our keyboard player, something a little piano, light piano kind of. There we go. All right, Susan, what have we got for Anthony?
I used to think Anthony Merwin was good at managing his time. I used to think he was the kind of guy who could make a decision and stick with it. I used to think he cared about the youth of America. But then I heard Anthony couldn't follow through on his plan to quit the MySpace.com. I don't know if it's true, but I've heard the MySpace is a den of iniquity. All midriffs and coarse language. All it takes is 15 minutes to cancel your account. Even a little old lady like me could do that. And haven't we had enough of people who don't know when to quit something they've gotten themselves into? Anthony Merwin, addicted to the MySpace. Oh, my.
Paid for by the Citizens Against Anthony Merwin.
Thank you. And thank you, Anthony. Now let's find Chris Kane. Chris, thank you for coming to In the Loop.
Thank you.
I'm sure you're really excited about being here at this point. Now, Chris, what was your flip-flop story?
Well, I flip-flopped on Starbucks because I had always viewed Starbucks as a big evil corporation. Then my hairdresser told me that she needed health insurance, so she went to work for Starbucks because at 20 hours a week she could get full benefits. And I thought, well, maybe they're not so evil because sometimes the big guys can do more than the little guys can do, and it's not so black and white. So that was my
interesting. So you are a Starbucks
I do go to
customer
Starbucks.
Now.
Yes.
All right.
And if it's wrong, I'll probably flip-flop back.
Well, we'll see how you feel after this little exercise. How about some a little more ominous music for Chris? There we are.
You thought you knew Chris Kane. You thought she would stand up to the big corporations. You thought she had good taste in coffee. But the frothy speckled foam on her upper lip tells a different kind of story. Her breath smells like a triple shot grande gingerbread mochaccino. Ask Chris Kane, is giving health coverage to employees really worth abandoning your convictions? If we can't trust Chris Kane on this, can we trust her at all? Chris Kane, one caffeinated flip-flopper.
Thanks, Gary. Thank you, Chris. Now, we've got one last one here, and this one just came up at the last minute. You know, there's this guy that we know. His name is John Paul, and he comes to a lot of the shows. Nice fella. We get an email from John Paul this afternoon saying, gosh, something's come up. I can't make it. We're very disappointed. And so we added poor John Paul to our roster this evening. Again, some sort of ominous music.
Well, John Paul said he was looking forward to In the Loop.
He said he was a big fan.
But then something changed about John Paul.
Something about some family event.
Family. Bah.
Can you really trust someone who places family above a free ticket to see a radio show?
I sure can't.
John Paul, flip-flopper extraordinaire.
Yeah. Hope we'll see you next time.
A big round of applause for Susan Fuller and Gary Grooms. And, of course, a nice thank you to John Paul for being such a good sport. Now, one last question for our audience here before we move on. Should we expect more consistency from our politicians than we do from ourselves?
My name is Mary from Minneapolis, and I think the major difference is, for me, when I'm making a change in my decision, I'm making a change just for me. As a politician, you're making a change not just for yourself, but for the group of people that you're representing. Or that you hope to represent. And that's what you really have to keep in mind from the beginning before you open your big fat mouth.
The idea is that you are representing the people who sent you there. And if you change your mind, you can't expect they all change their mind with you.
Right.
Thank you very much, Mary. Now, thinking about our personal stories, the way we all will flip-flop on various things over the course of our lives, brings us to the smarts tune for this week here on In the Loop. It's kind of a rumination on, in a way, how good all of us non-politicians have it when it comes to taking a stand on stuff. A song called That's My Indecision.
The world's not black and white. At least I think that's right. Then again, it might be. I wouldn't want to fight. So I equivocate. Changed my tune of play. Thoughts I thought were great then, and now the ones I hate. That's my indecision I'm sticking with.
water in my lungs slipped out past my tongue. Brain had no opinion. Soon as I was done, internally at war. Don't even know the score. Two sides to every story. And even more. That's my indecision. I'm sticking with it. Unless I change my view. Consistency's the hobgoblin of small minds. I've reconsidered everything I knew. Everything I knew. Everything I knew. If I should run or hide, or maybe stay and fight, at least to choose a side. On the one hand this, on the other hand that, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, on the one hand this, on the other hand that, on the one hand.
The Smarts. Thanks, guys. Joe Weissman on bass, Morris Engel on drums, Jimmy Kennedy on keys, and playing a fair bit of guitar for us this evening. More about them at thesmartsband.com. I'm Jeff Horwich. You're listening to In the Loop, and our topic tonight, flip-flop fever, deep in the heart of political territory. And I'm very excited about our last guest that we have on the show, Congressman Tim Penny, who's a familiar name to many people here in Minnesota. Thank you very much for joining us.
Good to be with you.
So, we have to abridge the biography quite a bit here. I apologize. Tim Penny was a Democratic congressman from Minnesota's 1st District for 12 years until 1994. And he's authored a number of books on politics. And at the moment, he's the president of the Southern Minnesota Initiative Foundation. Very important to our conversation tonight. He ran for governor in 2002. On the Independence Party ticket, which for listeners outside Minnesota, that's a pretty big deal. We are one of the few states with a viable third party. Now, Congressman, former gubernatorial candidate. As I recall, I mean, you're doing pretty well in the polls at a certain point. Then, you know, a character named Waffle Man crept into the picture, started following you around the state. As best you can suss out, what was Waffle Man's role supposed to be in this campaign? What was he doing?
To create a distraction and to generate some media coverage. He was picked up by some media, and I think the whole purpose was to just to create an impression that there's a candidate that isn't firm on the issues. And I think that's really what most of these campaigns are trying to accomplish. They don't care whether it's true or not. They just want to take a particular candidate off message. I mean, at that time, we had a huge budget deficit. It should have been the primary issue all the way to November, but instead, we're talking about a moderating view on the abortion issue all the way to November.
So, as a politician, I mean, how do you respond when you get tagged this way? You must have adjusted your campaign.
Yeah, I mean, you try to ignore it. You try to clarify. But as Dave Colling said earlier, when you're explaining, you're waning, and that does become a bit of an issue. And I think maybe part of the concern here is that I had an 18-year record in public office before running for governor. And if there was anything about my public image going into that gubernatorial campaign, it was very consistent, very solid, fiscally responsible, all of those things. The reputation was there, and this whole effort was designed to take that reputation away from me. And in this case, on one or two issues, it was a moderation, not a complete flip-flop, not 180 degrees to the other side, which is kind of, in some respects, the worst place to be, because you don't invite any new friends as you're giving up your old friends. And yet, I think my position on some of these issues was actually closer to where most voters are, but not where the most vocal voters are.
Well, you're running as a guy in the center.
Oh, yeah.
In a way.
Yeah, which is a problematic thing, but most voters are in the center. But, you know, when you get caught up in a controversy, that's all people hear. They don't hear the substance of the issue. They hear only that there's controversy about this issue. The other thing is that, digging back to the Republican strategist, the researcher who was on the program earlier, I mean, he's digging for a needle in a haystack, by and large. You can have a haystack full of evidence that you are this kind of politician with this view on the issues, but they find that needle and then they poke you with it. And again, it's not meant to be truthful or helpful or informative for the voters. It's simply meant to put you on the defensive.
So charges of flip-flopping, waffling, most voters, I think, like to imagine that these are tools that people are trying to use to fool us, that we're smarter than that.
More often than not, it is an attack that's used to confuse and misinform the electorate as opposed to enlighten and inform the electorate. And the media could play a better role here because they really do, they are the referee in this process. Because otherwise it's one campaign leveling this charge and then the other campaign having to spend its time and its resources rebutting the charge even if it's totally unfounded. And voters, I think, need to be a little bit dismissive of these attacks when they're leveled because in the vast majority of circumstances, the evidence just isn't there to justify the attack.
There's a bigger question here, bigger than you, I think, individually, which is, what is it doing to the process? Is this just a sideshow, or is there real damage going on?
Well, I think it does damage to the process in that it really steers us away from any thoughtful discussion of the issues. And in some measure, if your path to victory is tearing the other side down, oftentimes with inaccurate or misleading representations of who they are and what they stand for, I think that does erode public trust in the whole process.
As a politician, former politician at least, I imagine you have a certain amount of faith in the breed. Do you think politicians can genuinely change their minds? Should it happen more in politics?
Well, I think there are reasons when you might. I mean, you shared some classic examples tonight, and one is the Bush example, where we had Read My Lips pledge, but deficits were mounting, deficits were growing worse. He met Congress partway on a plan that had bipartisan support. You know, it's sort of like the Reagan example, where Reagan said, you know, I can hear the concrete cracking. Circumstances changed, and yet he paid a heavy price for that. It wasn't the only factor, but he paid a price.
So you've had 5 years or so to think about this. Where does it end? I mean, if flip-flopping is doing damage to the process, is there any way out?
Well, you know, I actually think the new media, it might be a way out, because I see a lot more investigation of what a candidate really stands for going on, and not necessarily all the blogosphere. But there are sites that are actually comparing and contrasting what candidates are really saying. So, you know, if we as voters want to seek out more information, you know, with a click of a finger on our computer, we can find a lot more information today. And so there's no excuse for us to be subjected and to base our decision only on these 30-second attack ads.
And new communications channels for candidates.
Hey, there are.
It works both ways.
And it's coming along.
Congressman Tim Penny,
I'm hopeful.
Thank you very much for joining us here on In the Loop. Now, we didn't set out tonight with our show to somehow fix the flip-flop mania that's become so dominant in U.S. politics. It's a beast far larger than In the Loop can take on. We did, however, intend to set a new record for the number of times you can say flip-flop in the course of an hour, and on that score, I think we're doing pretty well. The problem with flip-flop is that it is so prevalent, such an easy charge to make, that Americans take it for granted at this point. Tonight was about pulling attention back to it, seeing it as something more than just the white noise of the political season. I think Americans want to believe that our leaders can change their minds sometimes, responsibly alter their position, just like we all can, and we do. I think we'd like to believe that every little shift is not just blowing with the political winds. I think most politicians want this as well. The paradox is that their campaigns try as hard as they can to make it impossible for us to tell the difference between what's a genuine, informed change of heart and what's a charade. It seems like there are two things that come of flip-flop fever, neither of them very good. One is that politicians get scared of changing a position, even for the best of reasons. When the flip-flop vultures are circling, there's a strong disincentive to let their votes and positions be informed by new information and insights. The other is that politicians avoid ever really taking a position at all taking the broadest positions possible, or using every other political and personality trick in the book to distract us from policy questions. The outlook is not good. But, you know, it never really is when you look too closely at American politics. Flip-flop is here to stay. All we can do for now is be wise to it. And maybe, sometimes, crack wise about it. Yeah. You guys ready for this?
Yeah.
Here we go. I said a flip, a flop, a flippy to the flippy to the flip, flip, flop. You don't stop a flopping to the bang, bang, boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogity beat. And now what you hear is not a test. I am trying to get your vote. So it made the news, and when I changed my views about some stuff I said and wrote. See, I am here to win, and I'd like to say hello. If I change who I am, you must understand that a person's mind can grow. You know, stem cell research, rights for gays. I was for that stuff back in my younger days, but then I got wise, I saw the light, and it's gotten me straight to election night. I said, pro-life, pro-choice, what's it gonna be? I said, hey, diddle diddle, maybe somewhere in the middle, which me would you like to see? I might, no I won't, maybe nuke Iran, and I wouldn't, but I could invade Pakistan. Just throw your hands in the air, meet with terrorist states like you just don't care. And it's on and on and on and on and on, trying out new lines till the break of dawn. I said, one, two, three, four, I could not be more against the war. Yes, I did vote to authorize, but when we screwed it up, it was a big surprise. I said, one, two, three, four, now I'm way more against it than I was before. Skiddly bebop, we rock a Scooby-Doo. Well, guess what, Pat Robertson, I love you. You used to rail against guns, keep them out of my town. The NRA and me is totally down. I said, flip, flop, flip it to the flip, flip, flop. You don't stop a flopping to the bang, bang, boogie. Say up, jump the boogie to the rhythm of the boogity beat. Woo! All right, that's the smarts. Helping make me funky. Oh, we do some crazy stuff here. Thanks again to Susan Fuller, Gary Grooms, and the folks from NPR's Grammar Grader podcast. You can join the network of listeners who help us build the show, subscribe to our podcast, check out the Loophole blog, get tickets to future tapings, all that stuff. It's at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. In the Loop is produced by Julie Seipel, Sandon Totten, and Larissa Anderson. Our interns are Bradley Campbell and Anton Fryant. Thank you to Molly Bloom, Melody Yang, Andrew Haig, and Preston Wright from Public Insight Journalism. We get multimedia help from Christina Schmidt, extra assistance tonight from Ambar Espinoza. Our photographer is Jeremy Pavlik. Our technical director and trombonist is Josh Kubasta, with engineer Maury Jensen, and our live producer, Alan Freckman. Jim Gates is our editor and sometime trumpet player. Our senior producer is Mark Brule. Production of In the Loop is supervised by Leith Bishop. Our executive producer, Michael Scholar. Thank you to all of our guests tonight. Thank you to this wonderful audience here at Minnesota Public Radio. I'm Jeff Horwich. See you next time, In the Loop. Hello, this is Jeff again. Hard to believe, but we've got just two new episodes left this fall. To join our studio audience, reserve your free seats at minnesotapublicradio.org/intheloop. And we want to hear from you as we build those episodes, especially our last one. We're asking you for the trends and issues that you think didn't get the attention they should have over the past year. We're going to take your ideas and build our entire show around them. Head to the website and let us know what you think. And don't forget to tune in next week. Same loop time, same loop station.